Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of October. Coming up in just one moment, Sherman Alexie will be with us. He has a new book, a collection of very riveting short stories, War Dances. Of course, he's a very well-known novelist, poet, filmmaker, and National Book Award-winning young adult writer. And so he will be with us in just one moment. Rhonda Fanning is joining me, extraordinary producer for these hours from 9 to 11, and we're going to pledge drive in case you didn't notice. I'm sure many of you rely on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network for wonderful discussions every single darn day, and we're here to remind you that WPR relies on you to keep programs like this one on the air. It's our fall membership drive. A gift of any amount makes a big difference in our ability to pay for the programming that you count on. So make a pledge, whatever you can, a gift now online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Hello, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be with you this morning. Our goal this hour is to get 25 pledges. That's 25 pledges in the next, say, 57 minutes. And you can help us meet that important goal by making a contribution now at WPR.org, or you can give us a call at 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be speaking to Sherman Alexie about his latest collection of short stories, War Dances. I know you're a big fan of his work, and as everybody knows, Rhonda is a librarian. What do you find striking about him?
He's just a beautiful writer. It was high school creative writing class. Cameron. He has signed The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven as a sophomore, and then I plowed through that book of short stories, and then I had to go out and get all of his other ones, The Temple of Indians. Just, I guess his story was so striking to me growing up on a reservation, being in a high school class, and I was the same age as he was when he found his mother's name written in the front of a textbook. His mother had had the same book, and at that point he knew that he had to get off the reservation and attend a white high school. And so I've just been a big fan of his work ever since.
Isn't that amazing what a teacher can do? I think your microphone was a little off. We heard you, but not as strongly as we should.
Oh, okay. So that's all right, because I'm sick.
You're on mic
so maybe
three.
People.
Okay. There we go. It'll happen. Well, it's great. And I haven't been as familiar with him, but now that you have told me about him, I've read him, and he is very compelling.
That is true. And this hour, might I say, if you pledge $120, you're going to get a copy of Sherman Alexie's latest book, War Dances. So make your pledge now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And remember, when you give $120, ask for Sherman Alexie's new book of short stories, War Dances. It's simple to give, whether you can give online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. All we need is your name, contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. You can use a credit card. It will save us time and money.
And the goal this hour, again, is 25 pledges. You can, we've already gotten six this hour, so that's great. So we only have a few more to go. And you can call now at 888-202-2552 or log on to WPR.org and pledge online.
Every dollar really does make a difference, as you know, whether you decide to pledge $120, which is what people tend to give us, $10 a month or more. We actually had a pledge for $10,000 last week, which I've never had before, and we thank the person who gave us that amount of money. But I know, you know, who can do that? Not very many people. Most $120, and then you get a copy of Sherman Alexie's book, and I know many of you are big fans. So go online at WPR.org or call toll-free at 888-202-2552.
And I would like to thank a couple of people who have already donated this hour. An anonymous listener in Sussex says that he listens every day, and next to his wife, WPR is his best friend and a source of great information. Mary in Green Bay says public radio gives her a better voice in discussions with friends, family, and even strangers. How many times have we all said, you know, I started a conversation with, I heard this on public radio.
Exactly.
Probably quite a few times. So
Call now, 888-202-2552, and help these conversations continue.
Thank you. Thanks, Rhonda, very much. Rhonda Fanning, our producer for these hours, and we thank her. Sherman Alexie is joining us now. You can keep pledging, of course, and we're happy to send you a copy of Sherman Alexie's brand new book, War Dances, a series of compelling short stories. Sherman Alexie is a novelist, a poet, a filmmaker, National Book Award-winning young adult writer. His book has been called, as has his other body of work, Diverse, Tender, Witty, and Soulful. It's a collection of poems and stories in which he considers modern relationships from the most diverse angles. He's the author of many books of poetry, three story collections, 10 Little Indians, The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fist Fight in Heaven, and The Toughest Indian in the World, and four novels, Reservation Blues, Indian Killer, Flight, and The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, for which he won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature. He wrote and directed the film The Business of Fancy Dancing and wrote the award-winning screenplay for Smoke Signals. We welcome your phone calls to speak with Sherman Alexie this first hour today. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our on-air conversation this morning. Sherman Alexie, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, great pleasure to have you on the air. Let's start with your story, and I know it was in The New Yorker, I believe, in August of this year, and it's just so compelling, the War Dances story. And I don't know how much of this is true and how much of this is not true, so I'll ask you which one it is. But I know that you suffered what we call water on the brain when you were young, and it was very, very difficult for you. Did it resurface so you couldn't hear when you were a little older?
Oh, the hydrocephalus. No,
yes.
It didn't. My hearing loss was not related to the hydrocephalus.
Mm-hmm. But there was a hearing loss, so the story is true.
And it was addressed with steroids, but not the good kind of steroids, so I didn't get all muscular. I just got sweaty.
Sweaty, and you couldn't sleep, and it wasn't much fun, right?
Yeah, so, yeah, I didn't realize there were insomnia-causing steroids, so.
So how long did you have to be on them?
Oh, it was 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. But it shook you up to, obviously, it would shake anybody up to wake up one day, and I believe you were taking care of your children. Your wife was in Italy, and you couldn't hear very well.
Yeah, and then it, of course, the story is not what happened. So, and certainly for the sake of dramatic purposes, you heightened the tension. So it wasn't really as big a deal as the story makes it out to. So it was the combination of the hearing loss and the hydrocephalus and a dying father and World War II and a million other factors that went into one story to make it seem larger than it actually was.
And do you do that with most stories? How do you know what core you're going to use that is real and how you're going to heighten it?
Well, I guess it just depends. I don't write nonfiction. I don't write memoir. It's not what I'm doing. So it really is about an emotional, getting the emotion right. And a real-life event can inspire a sort of emotional state that allows you to write better fiction.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend some time talking about your dad. How long ago did you lose your dad, Sherman?
6 years ago, 6.5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about that process. How did he die?
He died of alcoholism, of system failure. He had been on dialysis for 6 years.
Oh.
And he had, well, it's a long chain of events, but the end result was he ended up deciding to go off dialysis and to let himself go. And before, we'd always talked him back onto the machine, but this time, without even consulting each other, my mother and siblings and I decided to let him go. And the doctor said he probably wouldn't last a month, but he made it 2.5 months, and he had some really good weeks in there where he felt better than he had in years. But after 6 weeks or so, he died. And in many ways, it was a relief after a lifetime of alcoholism and never knowing where or when he might die in a car wreck or from exposure or, you know, all the ways in which an alcoholic can die. And then, but of course, it was devastating as well to lose my father, as anybody who has knows, especially so prematurely. He was only 62.
Mm. Yeah, that is prematurely. You end that particular story with this sentence or sentences. I miss him, the drunk bastard. I would always feel closest to the man who had most disappointed me. I would imagine there's more than an element in truth in those lines.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the thing is, certainly I'm writing about my father and a fictional version of my relationship with my father, but, you know, I'm certainly not the only one who can write that sentence.
Right, you're certainly not, which is probably why your books sell so well. And
yeah.
People like what you write. I love the story. And just tell us how you have told it for those who have not read it, about the importance of the blanket in this story. It's just, I could feel your father, if this is heightened or if this is real, shivering after his operation and going through a hospital trying to find a blanket. It's just such a moving story.
See, there you go. That section is entirely fictional.
Right.
So
yeah.
The father character gets his right foot and part of his left foot cut off because of diabetic gangrene. He's freezing in the recovery room, and the hospital blankets are lame. So the son goes through the hospital looking for another Indian family, because he figures they're going to have good blankets. And as the other Indian he finds says, you know, you're stereotyping your own people.
Right.
And the guy says, I know. And he goes, but dang if we don't have a dozen blankets. New ones, too. You'd think my sister was having a litter. So he ends up interacting with this family who sing him a healing song. And even though he's suspicious of the healing song, as he says, there are a lot of Indian charlatans in the world. He takes the blanket back to his father, and then his blanket sings his own healing song for himself. It is probably a fairly memorable part of the story. It's what I've been reading on book tour, and it seems to get an incredible response, mm-hmm. that part of the story.
I'm sure it does, and it sort of makes a movie in my mind when the blanket is brought back and they're singing together, and the nurse who's been less than cooperative or less than friendly, who you initially, or the character initially asks for a blanket, finally finds one that's too thin. And the whole thing was playing in my mind.
Yeah, that's what good writing will do, you hope, is enter into people's minds. And even a strange event, an event they never would have thought of, becomes very familiar to them.
Yeah. Well, you did an interview in Mother Jones recently in which you said, I'm going to get grief from certain people about not having likable characters. As an Indian writer, I'm supposed to be showing us in our best light.
Yes, I said that.
I know you said that.
Well, I mean, there's a few stories in here where, well, number one, you're not quite sure if their characters are Indian or not. Their ethnic identity, you know, takes secondary or tertiary position behind their other kinds of identities. But the thing is, there's a few, you know, three quarters of the stories are about basically unlikable men and certainly not heroes. And I think because of politics, because of oppression, because of the history of Native American in this country, you know, most Native artists seek to put their characters in heroic positions.
Mm-hmm.
In direct opposition to the centuries of negative images that we've dealt with. But that's not art, that's social work. You know, it's up to us now as Native artists, this late in the process, to really start showing Natives in all their full complexity, heroic and villainous inside the same person. You know, I've been an Indian my whole life, and I've met thousands upon thousands of Indians, and the percentage of bad guys is just the same as in every other community.
Mm-hmm. So do you take grief from the Native American community or not?
Isolated folks. Well,
right.
Not isolated, but, you know, there's a certain percentage of Natives who don't like what I do, which means they're probably doing something right.
Right, exactly. I'm interested in your being a stand-up comedian. I just think that's one of the hardest jobs in the world. Are you still doing that, and how did you get into stand-up comedy?
Oh, I don't do it in the clubs anymore. You know, I found out fairly quickly that my kind of humor doesn't translate isn't really funny for drunken white guys in bars. So, although now, you know, I've sort of morphed into something that might work. But, you know, the thing is just standing up on stage, telling my stories. And I improv a lot. And over the years, it just got funnier and funnier. The thing about stand-up comedy is I'm just willing to say anything. You know, and at least one definition of funny is when somebody says what everybody's thinking, but nobody really wants to say.
Right.
So the release of that pressure inside people is laughter. And so I just think I'm able to get up and talk about anything, and that ends up being funny. And I just end up, the world is absurd.
Yeah, it is.
The world is absurd. And because I'm an Indian, because most of my audiences are lefties and far lefties, you know, it's a generally humorless group. So, you know, your listeners are by and large a humorless group. So.
Oh, I hope they prove you wrong in just a few moments.
Yeah, so so it's nice to make fun of them.
What was Stephen Colbert funny? I know you were on his show.
Oh, yeah, of course. He's one of the funniest, quickest people on the planet, you know, certainly. So, yeah, and it was scary. It was intimidating. And all my friends before I went on the show were kept saying, don't try to out-funny him. Don't try to out-funny him. But I think I held my own.
Yeah, I didn't see that one. Does he talk to you before you go on the set or not?
Yeah, in the green room, he just came in and said, if I was familiar with the show, and I said, yes, I was a fan. And then he said, well, then you know you're... I'm going to be an idiot, and you have to disabuse me of my idiotic notions.
And you didn't try to out-comedy him.
Oh, yes, I did.
Oh, you did. And it worked.
I did okay.
Good
you have
for
to
you.
Watch it. It's online. You can watch it at the Colbert Report website.
I'll do that after my shows are over this morning. That's the first thing I'll do after I have lunch, if I can wait that long. you learned to read by the age of 3? You were reading, is this heightened? You learned to devour, you read novels like The Grapes of Wrath by the age of 5?
Yeah.
No, that's true?
Yeah. I didn't understand it all. There's reading and then there's comprehension.
Right.
But I was sick because I was hydrocephalic. I spent a lot of time flat on my back, but the... one of the therapies the doctor suggested was reading. So my parents started reading to me. And, you know, as my mom says, I started faking it even earlier than that. You know, before I could even sit up, I was paging through books. So there was something innate and inherent in me about reading. And so I read, and it wasn't like the world was filled with kids' books back then, especially for a poor reservation family. So I just read whatever was on the shelves. And so my dad had a Steinbeck collection and also had Westerns and mysteries. So, you know, I was certainly reading Grapes of Wrath, but I was also reading about the John F. Kennedy assassination when I was 5.
Oh, my gosh.
So
that would have given you nightmares.
No, not any more than I already had. But yeah, my dad was a conspiracy theorist of the highest order. So his shelves were filled with conspiracy theory. So I think in a lot of ways that was his religion. So for many years, it was mine.
Is it now?
No, not at all.
Who do you think killed Kennedy?
Lee Harvey Oswald.
Hmm.
And, you know, with the Kennedy thing, I always believed until very recently about a conspiracy. I don't know, but if you go to Dealey Plaza, you'll see how small it is.
Hmm.
And you'll look up at that sixth-floor window, and you'll think, and I thought, you know, there are 27 guys on my reservation who could have made those shots from that window.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that far. It's not that difficult a shot. So, you know, I think every conspiracy theorist should go to Dealey Plaza and they'll change their minds.
And why do you think your dad was so taken by conspiracy theories, Sherman?
Well, you know, this is a complicated theory, but I think it relates back to the loss of salmon. The loss of traditional cultures, and you try to find a religion to fit. And he was Catholic in his early years. He was probably the only Indian of his generation who went to Catholic school on purpose. But so there was a spiritual religious absence in his life. And conspiracy theory is almost always, you know, a religious substitute for folks. You know, in order to make sense of a random and chaotic world, they try to put order on it. And there is nothing more ordered than conspiracy theory, where you see all these interlacings among people, where, you know, everything that happens is the direct result of action and this power structure. So I think my dad's lack of religion and then also his native identity, feeling colonized, contributed to all that, his powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
And his response to powerlessness was to be a conspiracy theorist. Mm.
Interesting. I love the story. I think it's called Salt. And tell us the outlines of it, of the young person, the 18-year-old, writing the obituary for the obituary writer. It's just such a, I mean, it's got surprises in it, but it's a really tender story as well.
It's a story about a kid off the res who has an internship at the newspaper in Spokane, and he ends up working for the obituary writer who dies, and in her will she asks him to write the obituary. So as he's doing that, and after he does that, he also ends up having to write obituaries for the first time. And this is set in 1985, so when an old woman calls him and wants to run her own obituary and run a photograph, he actually has to go drive to her house to get it. And then there he finds out that, you know, not everything is as it seems, and that, you know, she's living in a she has dementia and is living in a world where she's unsure of what's real and what's not, and so he is too. So it turns from a kind of a funny newspaper story into a eulogy for this woman, and in the end, a eulogy for a way of life. In some ways, it's also a eulogy for newspapers.
Oh, it is, isn't it? And a eulogy for the obituary writer.
Yes.
Yeah. Sherman Alexie is our guest. We'll welcome on-air phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sherman Alexie is our guest, and his latest book is War Dances, a collection of really compelling stories. We're welcoming on-air phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Before we take a phone call, Sherman, I want you to talk just a wee bit more about going to an off-the-reservation high school. You're the only Indian, you except for the school mascot. You're a player on the basketball team, and you got to imagine that must have been just a really hard task to go to a school like that. What motivated that?
Well, like I think you said in the introduction, it was finding my mother's textbook, my mom's name written in the textbook I was supposed to learn from, and I just knew I wanted to go to college. Being sick was actually ended up making me who I am in a lot of ways. And I think because I was sick, I was spending a lot of time off the reservation with healthcare professionals. I spent a lot of time around college graduates, which is the best way for you to become a college graduate, is for your peer group to be college graduates. So I always had that ambition. I knew I would never get to college if I stayed in the res school. So I transferred the next year to the white school on the border. And I didn't have the vocabulary for it back then, but I really was a first-generation immigrant into the United States. So I was indigenous and immigrant, which is pretty ironic.
Yes.
And we parked outside the school, and I walked across the street to the school, and that, you know, that little street in that little white town was really the Atlantic Ocean, and that little elementary school was really Ellis Island for me.
My. Let's take a call from John from Madison. Hi, John.
Hey, so a quick question for a funny Indian that you've got on there. And by the way, I'm a huge fan of Sherman's work. So Sherman, this is an unfair question, but I studied a fair amount of shamanism with both Native American and international teachers, and I always had, in a sense, an easier time with the international ones, because whenever I would interact as a white guy with Native Americans or with American Indians, there's always that thing, you know, that happened that gets between us, and either I feel like I'm a jerk, or they're mad at me, or they're not mad at me. But even when we try and let it go, it's still there. And so, again, back to the unfair question: how do you think? You know, what's your perspective on how do we all move past this and just be people who interact and learn from each other?
Never going to happen.
Oh, yeah?
Never going to happen. You know, the fight toward peace, the idea of reconciliation is, you know, in the end, it's a battle we all fight and should, you know, the battle for peace. But the thinking that the differences between humans are ever going to be solved or addressed is utopian thinking, and that's really when liberals get into trouble. Is utopic thinking. You know, that's when despots show up. That's when we join cults. So that's when we vote for Ralph Nader. So it's not going to happen.
You know, you have a lot of experience sort of interacting with the white culture. What have you done? You know, what works for you, in a sense, always getting these kinds of questions or always deep grappling with this issue between our...
I don't grapple with it. I don't spend my whole day worrying about this stuff. And you know, you're going in to study other people's cultures. You're going to get grief. And your idea that you shouldn't is probably the wrong idea.
You don't think it's a noble effort to try to achieve peace?
Oh, of course it is. Like I said, we always have to try. You know, but how many presidencies have been dashed on the rocks of the conflicts in the Middle East? You know, I'm always amazed. You know, the Bush administration treated those conflicts as something new. I kept thinking, you know, they've been fighting a long time, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. There's a couple books about it. Maybe you've read them. And the basic nature of human beings is to fight.
Sherman Alexie is our guest. His latest collection of stories is War Dances, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655 for your on-air contribution to our program. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We are in our Wisconsin Public Radio Fall Membership Drive, and our goal is to keep bringing you discussions with people like Sherman Alexie. We do that with listener contributions, WPR's most important source of information. And want to let you know that your gift of whatever amount you can afford makes a big difference as we raise money that we need to pay for the discussions that you rely on day in and day out and year after year after year. So please give online at WPR.org or call toll-free 888-202-2552. Rhonda Fanning is joining me with details on what our goals are for this hour. Hello again, Rhonda.
Good morning, Kathleen. That's right. We need to hear from 25 people this hour, and your pledge can help us get there. Thanks if you've already given. If not, help us stay on track by making your contribution right now at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552. You decide the amount of your pledge. But when you give at the $120 level this hour, you can ask for Sherman Alexie's new book of short stories, War Dances. So pledge now online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
I always like to talk about the news because if you're like I am, you're a bit of a news junkie. And I always, Rhonda will attest to this, try to tune in the news on the top of the hour on when I'm sitting at my desk reading other things as well. Fabulous news from NPR or 60-minute talk shows. You hear about the topics that affect your life. It's insightful broadcasting, taking time, resources, and dedicated people. We even laugh every now and then, which we are this morning. And listeners help you pay for the quality of the program that you hear every day. Give it WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Some listeners think that Wisconsin Public Radio operates largely with federal tax dollars, but federal funding makes up just 7% of our budget, just 7%. By comparison, listener contributions represent one-third of our overall budget. So your support is vital to keeping Wisconsin Public Radio on the air. So now that you know, make your pledge of support online at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552.
When we ask for your support, we're speaking to you. We've done a number of special things just in the last couple months. We went to Springfield last weekend and had a rip-roaring good time. We had a major healthcare conference at Frederick Hospital and have done major programming on healthcare reform. In Tomorrow is No Exception. We'll talk about that again. So, you know, call and say, okay, go in that direction. We like the fact that you're giving us more. You're listening right now. You value this program, and you rely on it being here for you and are doing some things that are special.
That's right. Again, that goal this hour is 25 pledges. So help now by going online at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552. And if you pledge at that $120 level, you will receive a copy of Sherman Alexis's latest book, War Dances.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. We'll talk to you later. Sherman is with us this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls on air at 800-486-8655. Our next caller is Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Oh, good morning. I'm delighted that you were on the air. I was so sorry that I couldn't be at Borders the last time you were in Madison, Wisconsin. When I spoke to you on air last year, I mentioned that back in the day, my relatives on one side of the family qualified for reservation status. But the grandfather felt strongly it would be the death of the family. He thought your only chance was to join the mainstream, and that is what they did, and I believe that was the correct decision. But one thing I haven't heard you speak to, and it's fine if you don't want to, is the huge rise of gambling in the Midwest, gambling establishments owned by the tribes and apparently out in New York. On the one hand, I hear people say the Indians have finally gotten the edge by essentially pandering, forgive me, to the worst instincts of people. And it's one of the few places left where you can smoke. So you have this combination of desperate wandering people hoping to strike it rich. It's like being in a submarine. You can hardly see. I worked at some of these places at special dinners and met a number of people that literally lost their homes while frantically thinking they could somehow make it all up. So on the one hand, people keep telling me the Indians have finally gotten the advantage over the stupid white man. And on the other hand, to me, there's something indescribably sad about what's becoming the major identification of tribes with a reasonably glorious history with gambling. Alas, my Indian part is not, as Sherman would say, I believe, one of the horse-owning cultures. I can't say that our tribe was associated with thundering across the plains, which is a real downer. But if you would have anything to say about that, I would be intrigued.
It's just capitalism. Capitalism at its worst. But Indian sovereignty has always been used in banal and base capitalistic ways. Cigarettes, fireworks, and gambling, the sort of an unholy trinity. I'm conflicted about it. I have all sorts of ideas about it. It's not a positive thing. It's not a negative thing. It's everything. And I guess the big thing to remember is that nationwide, more than half the employees of Indian casinos are non-white. So these casinos have actually rescued a lot of white folks in areas really hard hit by the failures of the farming, logging, fishing industries. So you have a lot of blue-collar white folks that Indians are helping out. But that said, Indian casinos, the money, I mean, certainly a lot of it goes to Indians, but you're really thinking about the casino companies that manage them, the people who make the machines, it often ends up being, Indian casinos end up being loopholes for white-controlled corporations to make money, where Indian sovereignty
Sure.
becomes a tax loophole. It's when you think about what capitalism is and how nefarious and convoluted and contradictory it can be, Indian casinos are just a fine measure of that. Mm. But on my res, my casino failed. Other tribes are doing really well, but what it really does when a casino does well is it has brought class to Indian tribes, and class struggles are happening, and you'll find all over the country these sort of battles. Near where I live now in Seattle, there's a tribe who opened up a casino, and there's all sorts of highly interesting and questionable activity going on, people being banished from the tribe. California, the same stuff is happening where, brothers are fighting over. It's Cain and Abel and a slot machine.
Mm-hmm.
So it can get very ugly.
Is this the future? There seem to be more and more tribes demanding the right to open the casinos.
Years ago, you know, you'll recall that Republicans were constantly railing against Indian casinos. But, you know, as I was always saying, as soon as Indians start giving a little bit of money to Republican politicians, that cry will stop. And so, you know, Indian tribes still give most of their money to Democrats, but now they give enough to Republicans to shut them up. So, yes, it will continue.
Hmm. And when you talk, Sherman, about bringing class to Indian tribes, can you talk about that a little more, meaning those who have really profited from these adventures or have fancier places, that there's envy? What are you talking about?
Well, the way in which in society there's rich and poor.
Right.
Now on Indian tribes, Indian reservations with casinos, the same is true. There's rich and poor. And while that is sort of a natural part of capitalism, it's also easily manipulated, and it can be easily corrupt. And so what often happens is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You know, and so, and there's a lot of nepotism. There's oligarchies on reservations where certain families control everything and other families do not. Certain clans control things, other clans do not. So it has taken sort of these age-old ideas of which clans and families are the most powerful and anointed them, and all of it is tax-free.
Right.
You could really, there are certain tribes and reservations in the country that are really operating as banana republics right now.
Thank you, Mary, so much for your interesting call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Sherman Alexie is our guest. Let's talk about race a little bit. I was interested that you were on that PBS Jim Lehrer NewsHour dialogue on race back, it seems like it was yesterday, but it was some years ago now with President Clinton. What kind of experience was that? Do you think that those kinds of conversations are valuable and perhaps even more so now because we have an African-American president, or are they meaningless?
Nobody who really needs to learn a whole bunch about race or relationships probably watches PBS. So in the end, I don't know that that panel accomplished much. The great thing about it for me, at least, or for natives, was, you know, I've gotten the kind of career now where an Indian is represented on those symbolic panels. So where Indians were absent from those discussions before. So I think that was great. And for me, I got to meet, you know, a president of the United States, and he was very funny. Afterwards, I was always joking, you know, afterwards, that's when he really started interacting with Indian peoples. So I think I influenced him, and I think all his speeches were secret love letters to me.
Oh, is that true? He started interacting as a result of your being on that panel. Well, that was worthwhile then, huh?
Yeah, so it lasted a few months. But the thing is, you know, I'm an Indian, so they're politicians. You know, I have natural suspicion and a natural hard-earned suspicion of politicians. That's why it amazed me that Indians fell so hard for Obama. It was a pigment thing. And, because I knew as a president, Indians represent no significant voting bloc. We represent no, you know, significant power. So, I knew when he became president that he would be no better or no worse for Indians than any other. One of the great ironies of U.S. history is that one of the finest presidents for Native Americans was Richard Nixon.
Really? How so?
He just believed he pursued a notion of independence and sovereignty for Native Americans, his administration.
Huh.
Sort of a libertarian approach, which ends up being usually the best approach to Indian politics is a libertarian one.
Huh, interesting. And I remember Chief Artisan, who used to be sheriff of Milwaukee County, was Hubert Humphrey's Secret Service guy years ago, and he used to tell the story. I'd love to hear it over and over about Humphrey being in a meeting of tribal chiefs from all over the country and Humphrey knowing the name without being prompted of every single person in that room.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a story, huh?
Well, that's... but it's a skill. It's an
right.
attribute.
It's a political
skill that politicians use to make people believe they care.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, oh, you remember me.
Maybe they do care, though. Maybe they do. Let's go to Gail next. Hi, Gail. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling because I had remembered hearing, if my memory serves me right, a few years back, I had heard an interview with your guest, and he was saying that he was actually sort of his first love was poetry in terms of writing, but it turned to prose by way of trying to make money, in as much as writers make money. And I was just wondering if I'm remembering right, and if so, if he's still interested in pursuing the poetry career, or whether he's become very attached to prose at this point.
Oh, there's poems in this book. And I've actually published a poetry collection this year, and then there are poems in this book. So you could argue that I published two poetry collections this year. So I've never stopped writing poems.
Didn't you start, or does my memory not serve me well, that you started being a writer really when you stumbled into a poetry workshop at Washington State?
Yeah, I was pre-med, but I couldn't handle human anatomy, so I took a bunch of different classes from all the different departments trying to figure out what I wanted to be, and I took a creative writing class, poetry, and it was it. I had read poetry before, but inside that class, I read contemporary poetry. You know, I read The Beats. You know, I read James Wright. I read, you know, all sorts of, you know, Black Power poets from the 60s and Allen Ginsberg, and so, you know, I essentially read the poetry of the invisible, at least they'd been invisible to me, and other native writers, especially Adrian C. Lewis, a Paiute poet. I read his poetry, and one line of his is what really did it. His first line of one of his poems is, "Oh, Uncle Adrian, I'm in the reservation of my mind." I read that, and that was it, and it hasn't stopped.
Yeah. Thanks, Gail. Pam from Milwaukee. Hi. Pam, are you there? Pam is not there, so let's go to Tona from Washburn. Hi, Tona.
Good morning. Well, I'm thrilled to be able to be talking to such a great writer. My question is, I'm married to a Native American from one of the poorest reservations in Wisconsin, and he's from Redcliffe in Bayfield, Wisconsin, and he was wondering about if there's any kind of associations or any kind of grants or arts endowments or something like that for Native Americans to either produce documentaries or films?
Nobody's ever given me money. I have, you know, that's the amazing thing for this career of mine. I have never received funding from a Native source to do any of my films or any of my artwork. There's never been a grant available to me or given to me by other Indians. So, you know, there's a single tear running down my cheek. So I don't know. And whatever I've tried, it hasn't worked.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Sherman Alexi is our guest, and we have time for one more phone call, which we'll take in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We'll take another phone call for Sherman Alexi, and it's Pam. I think we've reconnected with Pam from Milwaukee.
Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes, Pam, go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering if Mr. Alexi had a comment on what happened in Sedona last week. There was an individual from Milwaukee, in fact, who died in that lodge. So I'm just wondering if you had any comment on situations like that.
Well, if those of you who know about it, a faux religious leader in Sedona ended up, you know, I'm not exactly sure the legal term for what he did, but it certainly people died during this sweat lodge ceremony where like 40 people were crammed into a 20 by 20 foot room. And, you know, we're in there for hours with, you know, after fasting and feasting and you know, a couple people died. Well, it just goes to show, I mean, I've said this for years, you know, to my audiences, the second somebody asks you for money in a religious experience, run. You know, the second there's a fee, a registration fee, run. So, that's just a basic principle that's going to benefit anybody, is run away from any religious experience that has an entrance fee.
Sherman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sherman Alexie, the book is War Dances, a collection of short stories. We had a pledge just recently saying, I always support WPR. I'm especially happy to have Sherman Alexie's new book because I'll be on maternity leave in 6 weeks, and the short stories will be perfect for my time at home when I'm not listening to WPR, of course. That's a good one. And for $120, we're happy to send you his latest book. This is our fall membership drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Make your contribution now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Joining me now is Rhonda Fanning. Well, that was an interview, huh? I mean, that was enjoyable.
He's a shocker sometimes.
Yes, he is sometimes. What did you say? I'd say that again, but then, you know, you realize he said something that's certainly got more than a kernel of truth.
And
to
give it 30 seconds and he'll say something else.
Exactly.
But for $120 this hour, you can receive a copy of his latest book, War Dances, and help us make that 25 pledge goal this hour by calling 888-202-2552, or you can log on to WPR.org. Our goal this hour is 25 pledges, and we have about 10 minutes or so left to do it. The success of this fund drive depends on you. Thanks if you've already given, and we had a pledge this hour from Decorah, Iowa, our good friends
All
in Decorah.
All right, Iowa.
Marilyn says that some of her best reading occurs because of the books like Sherman Alexie's that she hears reviewed and read on WPR. So thanks, Marilyn. Thanks if you've already given. If not, you can give now. Join Marilyn online at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552. You can decide the amount of your pledge, but this hour, when you give at that $120 level, you'll get a copy of Sherman's book, War Dances, also the WPR member card. Log on WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Ron has been a bigger fan. I just haven't read a lot of Sherman Alexie, but I read a lot of the book last night, and he is a shocker, but he is one beautiful writer, too. He writes some passages that, as he says, are heightened from reality that are so striking, they almost make you cry. That piece that was in The New Yorker is a beautiful piece, with so much about his father and Indians and care and end of life. I mean, he tries to be kind of tough about things at times, but he is a very tender man as well.
It's true.
Yeah.
I remember a passage in his book about a dog that he had growing up, and it got sick. And so the dad took the dog out back, and he heard a gunshot. And it was he was like, well, it was cheaper for a bullet than to go to the vet. That made me weep. I'm sorry to tell you that story. His dog. I'm sure it was made up.
Yeah, I hope so. I didn't know what was made up and what wasn't. But no, it's okay. Because he gets you with that.
Yes,
you know, he gets you. At any rate, so what we wanted to say was this. When you give $120,
you can cry too.
You could cry in a story about a dog. No, it's okay. There's a lot of richness to what he writes, and he's funny as well. Ask for Sherman Alexie's new book on short stories, War Dances, and that, once again, is for a pledge of $120. How often do you get this kind of a pledge thing happening, anyhow?
Not very often,
right, Rhonda?
That's
not
right.
Often.
Giving at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552 is easy. All it takes is your gift of a dollar to a week, a few minutes of your time. And, you know, a dollar to a week really adds up to about $50 or $100 a year. And all year long, you'll benefit from this type of programming. All the WPR programs that you love, Joy Cardine, Larry Mueller, Ben Marins, Kathleen Dunn. Please go online now, WPR.org, or call 888-202-2552.
I'm sure that you've heard something on Wisconsin Public Radio that you wanted to pass on to a friend. Rhonda has done that, certainly, with booking Sherman Alexie, and he was funny and profound. With program notes on the website and audio archives, you can pass so much on. We talk about so many issues that are important. And maybe you already pass them on. I'm sure many of you do. It's a great way to stay connected with others, passing on ideas, stories, and information. It's all good.
We certainly did that on our Springfield trip. I don't know how many listeners told me about sharing their stories about the I heard this on WPR or starting conversations that way. One woman used the great line. She recounted some of her best driveway moments when she got to her destination but just sat in her car because she didn't want to stop the conversation or stop listening to the program. So please help these kinds of shows continue. Show your support online at WPR.org or calling 888-202-2552.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Alex Jones on Losing the News, the future of the news that feeds democracy. He says what stands to be lost is the fact-based watchdog over government, holds the powerful accountable, and gives citizens what they need. Alex covered the press for the New York. And we just wanted to let you know that that's what's coming up next hour. We're just teasing you. We got the wrong button. That'll happen every now and then. This is indeed... can we do this now? Well, we can't do this. Well, we were just going to have somebody giving testimony, but Rhonda's already given testimony from people who were on the bus with us. That would be a fun show sometime to have people call in with those driveway moments. I do that all the time with stories. I'm sure you do too.
I do. And it was great to hear that directly from our listener's mouth and share so many stories. Such an excellent trip. But again, back to this hour, our goal is 25 pledges. And at that $120 level, you can get a copy of Sherman's book, War Dances. So log on now to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And Clarence Page was the guy. We're picking up lines. The more we do pledge drives, the more we pick up lines. That this is your public option. For those of you who are concerned about a public option, this is your public option on radio. Isn't that a good line? That's why he's
everyone likes choices. That's right.
Yep. And so this is it. You don't find these conversations anywhere else. It's terrific. It's good. So and pledge.
That's right. And to provide great radio, we need to pay the bills, just like any other business. We count on listeners like you to help make your contribution today.
WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. John Treader for on-air production. Thank you, John. And thank you to Lisa Nalbandian for helping us along. And thank you for all of your pledges.